Good afternoon, everyone. This is Matt Malone. I run the content and strategy operation here at PrivGap. I'd like to welcome you all to our private equity and the software industry webinar today. This is an interactive discussion, or we hope that it is, so I invite you to all submit your questions in the Q&A panel at any time throughout the conversation, and we'll be doing an explicit Q&A session at the very end. It is clearly a hot environment for private equity software deals, as you can see by the chart I'm pushing up here now, and I'm very pleased to have our three guests here today to discuss it. We have Arvind Kumar from Thoma Bravo on the line. We also have Rob McIntosh from Autodesk, and we have David Van Wert from RSM, and I'm going to give them all a minute to give a brief introduction, and then we'll get into our discussion. So Arvind, if you could say hello to the audience and tell them a little bit about Thoma Bravo and your role there.
Sure. Hi, everyone. This is Arvind Kumar with Thoma Bravo. I'm a principal at the firm. I help lead our application software efforts, including verticals such as healthcare IT, energy IT, real estate, autos, et cetera. Thoma Bravo, some of you may know, it's one of the largest technology-focused private equity firms. We've been in business for 35 years. We helped pioneer the concepts of industry consolidation and buy and build investing for private equity. Today, we're solely focused on technology, and we have about $17 billion of assets under management. We've done 140 acquisitions in technology, representing over $35 billion in aggregate enterprise value. We're operating out of Fund 12 currently, which is about an $8 billion fund, and we have a $1 billion fund called the Discover Fund focused on mid-market technology companies. So we're one of the most active technology private equity investors out there.
Well, thank you, Arvind. Rob, if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself.
Sure, yeah. Hi, everyone. Rob McIntosh. I lead corporate development here at Autodesk, which means I'm in charge of all of our acquisitions, investments, strategic alliances, integration work, and then we also manage two different venture funds, one focused on 3D printing and another focused on kind of the future of making things, or our third-party platform that we're having others adopt as part of an ecosystem. For those of you who don't know Autodesk, we're a public company. We've been around for almost 34 years now. We have around $2.5 billion in revenue, $17.5 billion market cap, and we're a leader in design software for architecture, engineering, construction, manufacturing, media and entertainment, and some other verticals. And the way I try to explain it is, I mean, pretty much anything you see physically, be it a road, a car, an iPhone, a piece of furniture, or even digitally, be it a video game or a special effect in a movie, there's probably a very, very high probability that Autodesk software was involved in designing, simulating, or even making some of the different components of those things. We're an active acquirer. We've probably acquired somewhere around 100 companies in the last 8 years or so. And there's a fair amount of consolidation in our space that's fueling that, as well as just kind of our own transformation as business.
Great. Thanks, Rob. And David, please say hello to the audience.
Thanks, Matt. Hey, everyone. This is David Van Wert. I'm a partner at RSM. For those of you that don't know, RSM is the fifth largest accounting firm in the country and the top middle market accounting firm in the U.S. So I lead our M&A due diligence practice nationally for the technology industry. And within technology, I think we've worked on 300 buy-side and sell-side transactions over recent years. Happy to be here with Arvind and Rob today and provide my perspective.
Excellent. Well, let's get into our first topic, which is, I'd like you all to just give a bit of an overview of the market as you all see it. As you can see from the slide I'm putting up here, Certainly in the buyout space for private equity, there has been an ever-increasing momentum in terms of the number of deals being done. And so perhaps, Arvind, starting with you, can you give a little perspective on what is driving this deal volume today?
Sure. Yeah, within, I'd say, technology, I mean, it's a high valuation environment. So sellers are inclined, or prospective sellers are inclined to sell. It's very low interest rates, ton of capital out there, cheap debt capital. And, you know, software as an asset class and technology more broadly has really grown. It's in the face of lots of cyclical end markets, such as energy and retail, technology businesses, as digitization and automation has become more and more important globally, software has played a central role in that transformation. And so, irrespective of end market cyclicality, technology companies have generally grown, which is attractive to prospective buyers, old economy companies that want to become new economy companies, and small startup technology companies that are getting a lot of venture capital dollars to keep growing. So we're seeing lots of deal activity given the combination of strong macro trends as well as just very cheap capital out there.
And Rob, what are you seeing from your perspective in terms of driving deal activity? What's kind of drawing buyers and sellers in today's market?
Sure. I mean, so I agree 100%. I mean, cheap debt is certainly fueling this. There's excess cash domestically and foreign in foreign markets. You know, frankly, we've seen a pretty big overhang of private equity capital. It seems like there's, you know, recycling of assets as they spin from one PE firm to the next. And I'm not sure if those are necessarily great assets or it's just capital deployment that's taking place. You know, one of the things that I'd say is maybe just a hotter sector. Do you want me to talk about that at this point or just talk about the drivers at this point?
Sure. You can certainly talk about a sector if that's appropriate.
Sure. I mean, I think one of the factors, particularly, you know, within some of the enterprise software markets is just trying to change business models. And, you know, there was a reference that, you know, people are trying to drive to more contemporary business models or to more contemporary markets or platforms. And certainly there's a lot of startups that are active in developing great new cloud solutions. But in older businesses like Autodesk and others, we're seeing a big drive towards trying to drive both a business model transition, i.e. moving from perpetual software to term-based software, and then as well a transition from box software products or electronically delivered products to then pure cloud-based products. And so, you know, at least within our sector, we've seen a tremendous amount of consolidation as older businesses are trying to cross that chasm, and they're trying to move either the business model or they're trying to contemporaneously move to a more cloud-connected model, which requires new talent, new back-end systems, new delivery methods, maybe even new sales channels as well. And that certainly, as I've connected with my peers and older software businesses, that's been a huge driver for their M&A activity.
Thanks, Rob. And David, obviously, you talk to a number of clients active in the space. What are you seeing?
Yeah, I think echoing what Arvind and Rob said, I think that the ease of obtaining debt and I think noting that that's predicated on predictable recurring revenue, I think that that's obviously a large driver. Arvind mentioned that that technology is now touching all pretty much all industries and seeing that advancement, I think that's driving leading to M&A opportunities and in line with the constant change and disruption that you see resulting from new technologies, that leads to new opportunities. And then as just the nature of the technology industry, rapid innovation refills the M&A pipeline. And so I think there's never a true shortage of good companies out there compared to some other industries where you might see after a surge in M&A, there's kind of a lull because a lot of the best businesses have already been bought.
Well, great. I want to move into a little drill down into specific sectors that are seeing activity, given your relative experience and expertise. I do want to remind everyone watching and tuning in here to submit questions via the Q&A submission tool. Let's move from a sector perspective. Arvind, I know one that you're finding particularly attractive or active these days is in the healthcare software space. Can you talk a little bit about the opportunity there and who some of the players are?
Sure. I'd say some of the key themes. So first of all, Thoma Bravo's invested. We have 7 healthcare IT companies. So we've been one of the most active investors in healthcare technology. Some of the themes we've seen are regulatory related, which is the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare. Some of it's the High Tech Act, which was during the recession and had nothing to do with Obamacare. Some of it's just hospitals are making less money and need to improve their bottom line and use technology as a way to do that. On some end, there's dynamics going on in life sciences, on the payer side, and then just more across healthcare, but that where we're seeing themes. But I'd say I'd manifest that into 4 key themes, where revenue cycle management, alternate payment models, data analytics, and then the post-acute space, where we've seen a lot of activity. On the revenue cycle management side, it's an overused term, but how we apply it is there's an increased need for productivity and accuracy from customers, so that hospitals and providers can get paid faster and have less denials. That's a way for them to, as they're having to see more and more patients, to make sure that they're not getting they're doing a lot of services, but make sure they're getting paid for that in an accurate way and fast enough. That gets into the second point, which is alternate payment models. There's been a shift to not just move away from just fee-for-service and into more getting reimbursed based on value. So if you have good outcomes as a provider, you can get paid more. If you have bad outcomes and people keep coming back or stay in very expensive settings, you get paid less by insurance companies and by the government. So there's a reliance increasingly on quality of care, and there's a lot of technology companies that help assist in that in that transition. Third is data analytics, which is just being more companies that help providers, payers, life sciences, you name it, with processing lots of healthcare data. There's lots of systems that don't talk to each other is one issue. There's not just one closed system, but rather lots that interoperate, and so there's lots of lost in translation data. So that's important to first gather data, second understand what it's saying, and then third, be actionable, do something about it on retrospectively and then prospectively to avoid future issues. So there's a bunch of companies that help in that in that third theme. And then fourth is the post-acute space. Inpatient hospitals are getting hit pretty hard in terms of their cost base, and they're trying to shift to lower cost settings post-acute, where they're expanding care across the continuum into home health, into skilled nursing facilities, long-term care facilities. There's an aging population with chronic conditions that need to be met, cared for in an increasing volume, given the baby boomer phenomenon. So post-acute settings are growing in importance. And then so having healthcare technology systems that can help address that it has become an increasing focus for healthcare investors. So those are the 4 themes that we've really focused on. There are certainly others, but I hope that helps address the question.
Great, thank you. And I think we'll come back to some of the outlook questions later in the webinar. But let's, David, I know one thing that you've talked about is the the growing interest in cybersecurity. Can you talk a little bit about the complexion of that opportunity? I think we all understand that cybersecurity is becoming an increasingly significant corporate risk, but what are you seeing in that space in particular?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's obvious to everyone that cybersecurity is in the headlines on a daily basis now, you know, be it Russian hacking or hacking of the DNC. I think all of that creates a lot of hype and brings new entrants into the market. I think we're seeing needs not only for B2B cybersecurity assistance, but also for individual people and consumers. You know, they want to make sure that their data and information is safe as well. I read recently that I think it was 1 in 5 companies have been hacked or had some sort of breach, and I don't know if that data point was known breaches or estimates of companies that have had breaches, but it, regardless, I think the number is high and will continue to increase. I think one thing, interesting trend that we've been seeing is that cybersecurity companies are also becoming targets just because of the confidentiality of the information they have access to, and so that can be extremely damaging to the reputation of the business, but it can also crater a business that whose core competency is cybersecurity. You know, I'd liken it to a front page of the Wall Street Journal saying David Van Wert doesn't know how to balance his checkbook. I think that would be extremely damaging to my reputation as an accountant. I guess there are a lot of just given the threat to some of these cybersecurity businesses, I think that leads to additional risk to corporate acquirers or private equity acquirers who are looking to invest in these types of businesses. You don't want to take on a time bomb or landmine. I think from an M&A perspective, I think there has been a lot of froth in the market for security. There's been significant activity and high multiples, and I think given all of the new entrants, I would expect that there will continue to be very active M&A activity in the cybersecurity subsector. But I think we will see the best businesses being acquired, and a lot of the pretenders who have gotten in just jumping on the bandwagon will be falling off.
Thanks. And Arvind, just a quick follow-up question for you as it relates to healthcare. Is that something you're seeing particular activity when it comes to cybersecurity and privacy issues around healthcare? I guess, has Toma invested made any of those types of investments?
Yeah, we took private a company called Improvato, which is squarely in the overlap of both, single sign-on, really security software company that sells to hospitals and providers. So they're a good example of that phenomenon that we're focused on. It, HIPAA compliance and avoiding breaches of very confidential and patient information is really important in healthcare specifically, almost more than any other vertical. So Improvata is a company that we've backed to with that macro trend. Is there the best player in that space? Certainly something we're seeing.
And Rob, perhaps if we can now just move on to something you alluded to earlier, which is this notion of, the old line software companies looking to new models and startups that are launching with those new models. Can you talk a little bit about that opportunity and the types of companies that you're seeing come across your
desk? Sure. Yeah, so sure. I mean, so the first question is why? Why are people going to this effort? And, you know, anybody who follows the street and follows the valuations of various companies can see that, you know, companies that successfully are on a term-based model are typically more highly rewarded by the street, and it's a good model for shareholders in that it just is a more reliable business model. It's a more estimatable business model. But I mean, certainly you don't make those types of transitions, at least in business models, solely for shareholders. It also ends up being the right model for your customers as well, because you're able to provide a more minimal upfront capital investment. They're able to have more flexible access to their solutions based on need. And so, you know, therefore, the business model makes a lot of sense for both shareholders as well as customers. But it's the cloud transition that really enables both a company like Autodesk or others, as well as customers, to gain more value from their software. You know, there's oftentimes you see companies say, well, we're a cloud-enabled or cloud-connected solution, but really they're not leveraging any of the value that the cloud can bring. Aside from just providing more universal access to software, you see things like, in our instance, the ability to do rendering or infinite computing in the cloud. You have enhanced TAM expansion that you can offer by virtue of, you know, basically expanding your product or creating an ecosystem around your product that people can then latch onto and basically create long tail or adjunct solutions to your software. And so we've seen, you know, a whole number of companies that are starting up and entering our space or others, frankly, because the cost to create these companies is lower than it's ever been before. And people can leverage platforms like ours or Salesforce or others to basically get to scale a lot faster than they could have otherwise if they were to build a traditional enterprise software company. And so, you know, that's one whole kind of major trend that we're seeing, is just companies transitioning business model or creating more flexible models or better customer choice by virtue of having cloud-connected products. And then obviously, with that comes all the kind of contemporary themes or the big hot spaces, which you see in machine learning or in IoT or in our space in additive manufacturing or in others. And so basically they're able to leverage existing cloud platforms to get to market faster and also innovate a lot faster. And so you see the speed of innovation being very, very high. And you see venture money and private equity money following these sectors to basically, you know, splurge and spend to get to scale and get to market fast. So anyway, those are kind of two big hot themes that we just see continuously on a general basis.
And just for the audience's benefit, just when you're drawing this distinction about kind of the ecosystem idea, where you're allowing other people to, you know, integrate with your products, that's a distinction, for instance, Adobe's product, Creative Cloud, is one where, you know, you're deploying the software kind of in the old way on your own PC, and it's simply authenticating your license. You're talking about something sort of different than that, correct?
I'm talking about a true cloud-based or cloud-connected system. So an example for us would be if you're producing or creating the latest version of Avatar. In the past, you would have used, you know, a single server to render one frame of the Avatar movie, and it would take you 5 hours to render one frame. So instead of using one server, you basically can use our cloud and basically do burst rendering, where you can do, you know, 5,000 frames in an hour, for instance. So that's one example of being able to leverage infinite computing. The other would be, you know, a similar situation where if you're designing a building and you want to see all the different energy loss or energy consumption patterns that would happen if you switched the location of the building by 5 inches, or you turned a window to be slightly larger or slightly smaller, it could be simulating those responses and basically intelligently redesigning your building in the background as you continue to work on it. So that, I mean, that's the value of the cloud, at least within our space. It's not just about being able to, you know, pick up your iPad and log in and be able to see your data. It's actually leveraging the power of the cloud to drive better value for you.
Got it. Okay. Once again, I want to just remind everyone to submit questions via the Q&A panel. Let's move on to sort of the deal dynamics question. What the composition of buyers and sellers looks like today, and then perhaps some things that are keeping them apart. David, can you start us off talking a little bit about what the deal environment looks like in terms of the players?
Yeah, I think that just given that the multiples are still very high based on historical averages, I think that it's still the market is still very attractive to sellers. I think one thing that is probably keeping buyers and sellers apart is frequently just the preparedness of the seller. They might say, "Yeah, we're going to get a great multiple here and a great purchase price," but they haven't really done the blocking and tackling to prepare for a sale. So I think, you know, while we've seen in the RSM microcosm, we've seen the technology industry kind of lag other industries in adoption of sell-side diligence. I think that's something that has been increasing significantly in the last couple of years, just to speed up the transaction, increase the likelihood to close, and more importantly, just help to have a third-party viewpoint to vet the issues on customer retention, revenue recognition, quality of earnings, those types of things. But I think in terms of who's really calling the shots in a deal, I'd say any transaction is a negotiation when it all comes down to it, and it probably depends on what type of deal you're talking about. For instance, I think a seller probably has much more negotiating power if it's a non-exclusive auction transaction versus a proprietary deal versus a, you know, maybe a minority investment where, you know, it truly is a partnership going forward, and no one wants to draw blood from the other party during the transaction.
Arvind, what are you seeing in terms of the particular deal environment today?
I'd say it's pretty bifurcated in terms of we're seeing very, very high quality private companies, you know, not trade in the public markets, very high quality private companies transacting given, you know, the high multiple environment. They're getting pretty large enterprise value EBITDA multiples. For example, Camp Systems would be one. We just sold Deltek. We announced it, our sale of Deltek to Roper just last week, which is one of our best companies. So we're seeing top quartile, you know, top decile quality businesses sell for pretty high, you know, multiples. On the other hand, because there's a scarcity of assets out there, there's not that many really. When I say good companies, it means a lot of recurring revenue, very high retention rates, stable end markets, pricing power, you know, high EBITDA margins, high gross margins, those types of characteristics. There's not that many of them, especially in the size range that we transact in. So there's a supply-demand imbalance. On the other hand, there are, on the public side, there have been a bunch of transactions where companies came out with very hot IPOs, but were not mature, not super well-run, and they keep missing quarters of earnings. And so there's been a lot of growth in the activist investor community. And so there's been a lot of deal companies put into processes because of activist investors in the public markets. So we've seen a huge amount of growth in those in take privates put into play by activists because of just poor guidance and then missing numbers consistently.
Great. Well, thank you. Rob, you and I talked before the webinar a little bit about your perspective on deployment of capital and sort of what's driving volume, and I think in your mind relating to the amount of capital available, some of the overhang. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like I'm not in private equity, but, you know, traditionally we haven't seen a lot of private equity players involved in our space. And maybe the attractiveness of the sector is increasing. But, you know, it used to be that when we came to bid on a deal, if a private equity player was involved, they typically couldn't move that fast, or they just had tertiary interest. And what we've seen recently, we've seen a recycling of private equity deals, but we've also seen private equity players coming in and bidding much more than the strategics. And maybe my sample set is small, but you know, I probably have 5 to 10 transactions in the last year where the sponsors were outbidding the strategics in some cases by a factor of 2 to 1. And so it's a really curious trend for us, considering, you know, eventually, theoretically, either a strategic or a public markets would be the end point. So it does seem like there's some amount of overhang here that's driving activity. And typically, what we've seen, at least in sponsor deals, is that, you know, tier one sponsors are not selling their transactions at those high values to typically other tier one sponsors. They seem to be going to the tier threes or tier fours, which leads me to believe there is, you know, some amount of capital overhang that's starting to drive the activity here. You know, and values are high, right? Values are high, untouchable assets that, you know, we thought would never be for sale suddenly are actually selling, and by untouchable, I mean highly desirable. People have been banging on the doors for years. No one's been able to get into the door, but they're actually, you know, engaging in processes. Timelines are much, much faster than they've been in the past. And, you know, we've seen just a big influx of activity. It just seems like it's really high.
So, Arvind, I know that Toma Bravo does not overpay for deals, but I guess as a sponsor, how do you avoid, you know, protect yourself in a market like this with high valuations, a lot of competition? If you do in fact the phenomenon that Rob talks about with sponsors outbidding strategics, how do you make money in this environment?
Yeah, it's really it's a good question. We're seeing a lot more competition, and we're seeing some folks that Rob mentioned, tier three type sponsors that haven't been in software technology trying to get in, and they're just overpaying, which they know and we know. So it's, you know, you find your win rates probably going down a little bit, but that's probably okay because those deals you'd be not making much of a return on if you did bid them. So the deals we are doing, you know, we need to stay disciplined. And I think the deals we're doing are where we only buy the right assets where we can add value through operational improvements, where the, you know, our pattern recognition from doing 140 technology deals can be differentiated versus anyone else. So these are ones where they usually have very high revenue quality but are just not managing the business the right way, so for a variety of reasons that we think we can help improve. And then when we, with that conviction, with higher growth and higher margins that would come our way, you know, we usually try to focus on companies that also have a fragmented end market where we can do M&A to, you know, either extend product lines or buy competitors or go into new geographies. And that adds more earnings that then you can borrow more against, and it's a virtuous cycle, which software has. Software has great characteristics in that respect. So long answer to that question, but it's one where we have to find the needle in the haystack companies that, you know, where we think what a headline price that may look high on a pro forma basis we think is much more reasonable due to some of the through some of the pattern recognition that we have, where we can improve a business much more quickly. Does that make sense?
It does. I want to move on to Q&A in a minute here, but I wonder if each one of you could just perhaps give a, you know, 45 second to a minute on your outlook for 2017, and some of this will probably also be touched on in Q&A. But David, perhaps if we start with you, what are you looking at for the coming year?
Yeah, I think it's tough to predict. You asked me a few months ago if I thought the Dow would almost be pushing 20,000. I probably would have said no, but you know, I think I would expect that, particularly in the technology industry, I think you will continue to see the large kind of blockbuster transactions and the larger take private deals once the frothiness in the public market dips a little bit, and then I think that will, on the flip side, you'll probably see a lot of add-on acquisitions as as current holders try to bolster up their portfolio companies and really fill the gaps in terms of technology or sectors or region. I think it's that middle space where it's a little bit more uncertain for your middle market technology companies. But I would expect 2017 to be active.
Thanks, Rob. What are your thoughts?
It certainly seems like it's going to continue to be active. It's odd. At the end of last year, I recall going to a meeting with a whole bunch of corp dev people, and we were all looking forward to the crystal ball for this year. And everyone said, "There's no way we can match 2015. It was just such a crazy year. We finally get to take a break and relax." And as you can see by the numbers you put up at the beginning of the webinar, this year has been a record year in software M&A on both numbers of transactions as well as total deal consideration. So, it's been a pretty robust almost 3 years at this point, but I don't see it at this point necessarily slowing down, at least not in massive ways, maybe a little bit here and there. I think there could be an influx of M&A activity if, corporates are able to repatriate cash to the U.S. as well. That should end up, I think, would fuel even greater M&A activities, particularly domestically.
Arvind, did that perspective consistent with your view of the 2017?
I agree that the first half of 2016 saw more technology deals than the entire 2015 by a couple percent. I see 2017 probably growing relative to 2016. I say I agree with Rob that the repatriation would be a boom for corporates. I'd say on the private equity side, the Fed's talking about rate hikes, which adversely impacts cost of borrowing and then adversely impacts usually the interest rate on the debt and maybe how much you can borrow. So that would bring asset prices down theoretically in what private equity companies can pay, and maybe the imbalance that Rob was mentioning where private equity is paying twice as much as corporates will rebalance a little more. I'd say also we'll have to see what happens with the new administration, but there's a bunch of uncertainty around that, not necessarily priced into the markets right now. Usually with more uncertainty comes higher interest rates, and again, the same end result in terms of the amount you can borrow. So those would be the caveats to why maybe either prices get more, moderate, and or why there's some less private equity buying or versus corporates. But those are, I agree with the overall trend line.
Great. Well, thanks. So let's move now into some questions that our audience has submitted. And I'll push this out to either one of you to answer. But any thoughts on the deal environment or competitiveness within the lower middle market? So talking the 15 to 40 million EBITDA range relative to sort of other parts of the market?
I'm happy to take that. This is Arvind Kumar. We have a Discover fund that focuses on exactly that, and they've been very active. They see probably 20 deals at least a week. There's a lot of activity. There's more activity in that market relative to the size. And I think that's an area that, from an investor standpoint, you can still have more value, better returns, better multiples, where the supply-demand imbalance isn't as out of whack. I guess that's how I would characterize that size, the 15 to 40 million EBITDA businesses. We're seeing a lot of activity, there's probably a little less competition from our viewpoint those size deals than larger deals. And, there's those size companies, there's a lot of them. So in terms of the consolidation of fragmented end markets, there's that opportunity is pretty ripe. I don't know if Robert.
Great. Robert David, any thoughts?
I haven't seen any difference, be it large or small. It just seems like across all, as long as there's growth and good, general characteristics of the business, they're still just as robust as any other asset.
Yeah, this is David. I would say that the lower middle market may, and I think Arvind was alluding to this, sometimes the lower middle market provides a private equity group more opportunity to insert expertise, and also provides kind of that bridge between the growth VC investing and then more a majority transaction or buyout. So I think, you know, the just because the companies are smaller and frequently tend to have ironically even more hair on them than a larger company would, I think it is a subsector or a cross section of the M&A market that can be very attractive.
So, David, on to the next question, and I believe that you mentioned this earlier, and if not, if whomever did can jump in, but we have a question from someone asking about defining the blocking and tackling that can be done by a seller in preparing for a sale. So what are the steps to make a business an attractive target for private equity?
Yeah, I mean, I think step number one, make sure your house is in order. You know, make sure that you've got your reporting cleaned up and you've got your advisors lined up before you go out to market. I think a lot of the time sellers may jump the gun and say let's start talking to people about selling. Oh, someone mentioned an investment banker. We should go hire one of those. Oh, someone mentioned sell side diligence. We should do that too. And really letting the tail wag the dog. I think in terms of fundamentals, you know, a private equity investor is going to be looking for recurring revenue, ability to increase prices, white space in the market, you know, management team quality, the technology itself and how good that is. And how scalable that is. I think those are some of the factors that a buyer is going to definitely look into. Arvind probably has some additional perspective on that as well.
I think
Arvind,
you hit it on the head. Yeah.
Okay.
I think you hit it on the head, David. I don't have too much more to add to that since. We work with firms like David a lot, like our McGladrey a lot. I think that's exactly what they're hired to do.
We have sort of a specific question relating to, let's see, sort of the industrial technology space and how that's being viewed in automotive or other similar manufacturing applications. Rob, some thoughts on that?
Sure. I mean, look, so there, if I were to kind of maybe extrapolate what, or at least the way I'd try to interpret that question is, you know, in particular in industrial applications, we think there's a massive opportunity in terms of how people are redefining the factory. We call it the factory of the future. And you see this convergence of additive manufacturing, i.e. 3D printing, plus automated factory lines, plus connected devices so you can do machine-level monitoring, and you have the whole IoT layer. You have all these different things that are coming at it that basically enable you to have more efficient factories, better usage of materials, and more capital-efficient just kind of general designs and manufacturer processes. That even enable you to potentially have lower headcount or much lower shipping costs or otherwise because you can actually set up factories or little micro factories in either specific countries of service or even on site in certain areas. And so it's a hot sector right now. You see GE investing a lot in this space. You see Siemens coming after it. We're coming after it. Our competitors are coming after it. But mainly as it relates to the new stuff in terms of how you're re-architecting or invigorating the space, less on kind of the old school industrial technology or industrial software stacks that are heavy ERP or EE or require big implementation times. These are lightweight, easy to install, easy to get going, and high ROI applications.
Well, excellent. Thanks, Rob. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I'd like to thank Arvind Kumar from Thoma Bravo, Rob McIntosh from Autodesk, and David Van Wert from RSM for sharing their insights with us and for all of you for tuning in. Please do visit us at privcap.com, where we have this sort of content on a regular basis. There will also be a replay of the webinar available at this address and in a day or two on privcap.com for those of you who might have joined in the middle. But until our next webinar, I'd like to say thanks to all of you and happy holidays.